eagle, dive like the hawk. Hear the drums of the Nez Perce people, listen to the mountains talk. In the high Wallowa Valley, the Nez Perce people live.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is William T. Volman. Volman's the author of 10 novels, 4 collections of short fiction, a memoir, and 6 works of nonfiction, including the 7-volume treatise on violence, Rising Up and Rising Down. His latest work is The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, which is book 5 in his 7 Dreams series of historical fiction. Jane Smiley wrote in her New York Times review of the book, Volman's one of the most idiosyncratic and challenging novelists at work today. The Dying Grass, like his other works, daringly pushes at the edges of the novel as a form, while at the same time demanding that the reader sit up and pay attention. Bill Volman, thanks for being here on KBOO.
Oh, well, I'm happy to see you again, Ken. Thanks for having me.
You know, when you appeared on Between the Covers last summer, we talked about your book, which had just come out then, Last Stories and Other Stories, and you included a note to the reader in the beginning of that book, which starts out, "This is my final book. Any subsequent productions bearing my name will have been composed by a ghost." So let me start by saying it's good to see you're still around.
Well, it almost was my final book after all that double IPA we drank together, Ken.
Yes, that was a little too powerful. We'll go for the single IPA after the interview. The Dying Grass is book 5 in your series, 7 Dreams, a book of North American landscapes, actually 7 books of North American landscapes. The series, and I quote here, examines the repeated collisions between Native Americans and European colonizers. Each volume focuses on a different period of the American continent, fusing historical facts with fictional untruths to create what you call a symbolic history. And what do you mean, Bill, by symbolic history?
Well, I think that a novel can get at things which are not necessarily literally true, but by breathing life into characters who, since they're dead, must be incompletely known, we can make them true in a different way. So in the Dying Grass, for instance, one of the major dynamics is between General Howard and Colonel Perry, who lost the Battle of Whitebird Canyon. And in fact, Perry did not go with Howard all the way along the Nez Perce Trail. He was sent in a different direction to try to intercept Joseph in case he went that way. But I decided I wanted to keep the dialogue going between these two characters, and I had them actually together all the time. And I don't feel bad about that sort of thing as long as I indicated in the source notes at the back. So if people are wondering, they can look it up and see where I deviated.
I noticed also in those source notes, you have a quote here about the 7 Dreams series and symbolic history, and you mentioned that you do alter history, trying to get probably more at the truth there. And then you say, of course, all my 7 dreams do alter history, but this one more than any of the preceding volumes rejiggers events. Why did The Dying Grass require more of this rejiggering of events?
Well, in the case of the cavalry, the way maybe the army works, you know, is that individual soldiers are somewhat interchangeable. And so in the course of this very, very long campaign covering different military departments, General Howard would be commanding different soldiers who would come into the story and then drop out of it. And I thought, really, this is too much to demand of the reader when we're already having all these voices and it takes the reader a little time to get to know them. So, you know, once the reader has some idea of a character, let's keep that character around. So that was the reason. And then with the Nez Perce, a lot is unknown about the family situations of people. It was not especially common for the wives of chiefs even to be known to outsiders. So I had to say, well, let's say that Looking Glass's wives have these two names, you know, which I picked from a Nez Perce dictionary, which had lots of names in it. And he might have had more wives or fewer wives, you know, so I was just doing the best I could.
This question is more for the whole series and the origin. I read you did an interview and you said you had written a book of short fiction with San Francisco as the main locale called The Rainbow Stories, and that was about 25 years ago or
more.
Yeah,
I guess it was, yeah.
And you had mentioned that the origin of The Seven Dreams, which also started about 25 years ago with The Ice Shirt, you mentioned the series idea came out of The Rainbow Stories because Rainbow Stories was all these parking lots where the whores were doing their business. I thought to myself, what was the country like before all the parking lots were here? And this struck me as very interesting because last year when you were here, I drove you from the hotel to KBOO, and we were downtown, the hotel's in downtown Portland, and you asked me about 10th and Morrison, and you said, can we drive by there? And apparently that was the home of General Howard and his family, especially during the course of the book, or 1870s.
That's right.
And it's a parking lot now.
Well, it could be more perfect, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So I kind of got a little kick out of that. When you see something like that, when you see this historical site that you're writing about and you've done incredible amount of research and excellent research on.
Oh, thank you.
Does it give you more of a drive to recreate that landscape as it once was, especially in the Seven Dreams books and the Dying Grass?
Yeah, I'd say so. One of the nice things about the Seven Dreams is that many of these landscapes are still somewhat the same. You know, the Ice Shirt involves, in part, you know, the Viking explorer Eric the Red. And you can go to the ruins of Eric the Red's farm in Iceland, and you can walk around. You can see the stones that once, you know, rose up and made a house or a barn or whatever. And you can have probably, you know, pretty close to the same view that Eric would have had, you know, back in about 995 AD. And along the Nez Perce Trail, there are many, many places that are so rugged and wild that they have been somewhat left to themselves. And you can say, all right, I get it. This particular place right here, say in Hell's Canyon, it must have required remarkable horsemanship for the Nez Perce to cross with all their people and livestock, go down this steep declivity and then up the other side through a very strong river. You know, certain things do change, you know, with global warming and
and the dams along the Columbia, too, because you had mentioned they're fishing at Celilo Falls, which doesn't exist anymore.
That's right.
It's kind of a trickle compared to what it was.
Yeah, that is for sure. So you have to kind of factor that in and do your best.
We did mention the Seven Dreams. They're all based on actual historical events, times and places and even people. Like you had mentioned, Eric the Red, and here we have Chief Joseph and General Howard. And they're basically all a conflict between indigenous peoples in an area versus the invaders, who are usually the European colonists. How do you choose the subject matter for each of the Seven Dreams?
Well, I wanted to pick stories that were somewhat well-known, maybe even iconic, in different regions of our continent. So Argal, one of the Seven Dreams books, you know, that was a no-brainer to choose because of the
John Smith
and Pocahontas. Yeah, that's right. And Chief Joseph is known for, you know, for saying, I will fight no more forever, which he might have never said, and for being a great war chief, the Red Napoleon, whose battles are still taught at West Point, and he probably was not that either. But he was a very brave, long-suffering, eloquent person who advocated for his people after the war without getting much, but he did his best. And almost everyone agrees, you know, when they look at the story, that the Nez Perce were not in any way to blame for the events leading up to the war, even though it was some young Nez Perce men who finally, you know, goaded beyond endurance, committed atrocities and started the war. It's a very haunting, sad story, you know, that takes place in a number of American landscapes. And you see the Indians trying every possible method to deal with the aggression of the whites. And every single strategy, you know, resulted in failure. So the Looking Glass Band did what General Howard told them to. and they went on to their little reservation and stayed there. And Howard then decided that they were untrustworthy and sent to have them arrested and their horses confiscated and pushed them into the war. You know, then there were the young men who decided to attack because they didn't want to be starved and, you know, and impoverished otherwise on the reservation. So that didn't go very well. And then there were those who wanted to flee. And they tried to flee first in this direction and that direction, and none of it worked out. You know, there was one band, Whitebird's band, that managed to get across the border into Canada and join up with Sitting Bull. And in a way, they might have had the best outcome, but then pretty quickly the buffalo were all gone, and they were starving like everybody else. So it's a pretty grim story, and it makes you realize how few choices the Nez Perce had that would do anything.
You even mentioned in the book there's a group that go in and try to negotiate with General Howard, and they're arrested. He has no room for negotiation, apparently.
Right. Yes, it's quite sad.
You do an incredible amount of research, and you've been quoted as saying, before you start either fiction or nonfiction, you say, "I try to know as much as possible." And you know so much that comes across in the book. I'm wondering, how do you determine when you know enough to actually write the book?
Well, writing The Seven Dreams always involves a lot of drudgery at the beginning. You know, first I have to say, all right, you know, who are the people, say, in this Indian tribe? Or who were these cavalrymen? And what kind of clothes did they wear? What kind of hierarchy did they have? How would they have related to each other? You know, what about male-female relations? And it takes a long time to get up to speed on that stuff.
So it's research and then asking yourself these questions that come up as you're doing the research?
That's right. You know, the way that people spoke and wrote English in 1877 is not dramatically different, but subtly different from the way that we do. And so I wanted to reflect that. That took a lot of study. If you read a paragraph of The Dying Grass, you might not notice. If you read three or four pages, you might think, this is a little odd, you know, the way today is hyphenated, for instance, things like this. So I needed to get all that stuff under my belt before I could really proceed with any confidence to try to create character.
And that was usually by reading actual journals from that period to see how people talked or wrote.
Yes, anything I could. Journals, military manuals, works of anthropology that describe the sorts of things that were found in Nez Perce villages, all kinds of things. I ended up reading a lot about the uniforms of the Indian fighting army. That turned out to be quite interesting to me, and I didn't want to bore the reader, but I needed to know what these soldiers would look like, and it sounded as if they were quite motley. They might make some of their own gear, and they had old surplus stuff and newer stuff. None of it quite matched, and the Leavenworth contractors were ripping off the army. So sometimes the shoes would be no good, and they would just have to live with that.
To get more into the book, you mentioned the dialogue. You try to be as truthful as possible to that period and the way they talk. I think when somebody opens the book, probably the first thing they'll notice is that the topography is different than a regular book. And this is a structure that you invented for this book, where you have white space standing in for kind of a physical or emotional distance. And I just got a statement here you made in an interview with The Atlantic. You said, "You don't read this book like other books. Instead, as you read from left to right, the page works like a stage. The left-hand part of the page works like a forefront of the stage, and the right edge of the paper is the backdrop." Can you explain how this structure works and how you came up with it? Again, it's very innovative.
Oh, well, thanks. Did you ever read that Peter Matheson book, Far Tortuga?
No, I've heard about it, but I haven't read it. Does he do something similar in there?
In a way, yeah. It's very, very interesting. I read that in the 80s, and there's much more white space in that book.
And a lot of dialogue. Patois from, it's the Caribbean region, right?
Yes. He'll represent a dawn or a dusk with a rising and falling sun picture. And when someone dies, there's a cross. And so just a lot of very short, simple words suspended in white space so that it's almost like a movie in a way. And I found it very impressive. And it kind of gave me the idea for Dying Grass in a way, except that I decided to do it a little bit differently. My original plan was to have three columns in the book, and the center column would be the landscape description. And then on the left and right, people might be interacting with each other, or someone might be coming, someone else might be leaving, whatever. And in the end, I found that too rigid. I realized all I needed to do was to have a series of indentions. So maybe someone on the left-hand side of the page is saying, "Oh, yes, sir, General Howard, sir." And then indented, you find out that he's actually thinking all kinds of furious and profane things about General Howard as he's...
Yeah, there's quite a few conversations like that.
Yeah, that's right.
He's a coward. He's a lover of Negroes, as you put it in the book, and Indians.
Exactly. And so there are a lot of things you can do with that kind of structure. When I'm representing a battlefield, I might have sort of a cacophony of voices scattered all over the page. And then maybe one voice gets louder or more important, maybe as the character we're following moves closer to that person or he comes closer. So it's a way of representing space. And when the Nez Perce are traveling, the descriptions of them is sort of an undulating S-curve. They'll talk about this person and what he's thinking, which will be indented, and then someone else is indented a little more. And then that thought is completed, and it comes slowly back, and then we're at the landscape. And so things just sort of sway back and forth, like people riding across an undulating plain.
There's one section here I didn't quite get. I was wondering what you're doing with that. It's a chant or kind of a song that's about midway through the book, and this is during one of the cavalry sections. You usually alternate between cavalry point of view and the Native American, the Nez Perce point of view.
That's right.
And it's must have been an original song that you got. The bold dragoon, he has no care as he rides along with his uncombed hair.
That's right.
And it's repeated over about maybe 30, 40 times, starts towards the right margin of the page, and gradually, with each line, migrates a little closer to the left margin of the page.
That's right. And I meant to suggest what it must have been like, you know, to be in the Army. And if this was the ditty that was popular then, you probably couldn't escape it. You would just be going on and on and on.
Like a song that won't get out of your head, even though you wish it would.
That's right. And since the Army was on the march, I decided, let's indent each iteration of it a little bit differently. So you look at it and you see, oh, okay, so the song is moving. Because, of course, the soldiers are marching as they sing it.
Wow.
So that was my idea anyway.
I got the idea. It was very cinematic anyway.
Yeah.
And so not just with the oral part of it, if you're reading it out loud or reading it to yourself, but the visuals of the topography kind of almost give it an extra dimension there, like a movie.
Well, I tried anyway, yeah.
No, it works really well. I want to emphasize to the listeners, too, even though we just spent a little time explaining the structure, it makes the book even that much more readable. That three-column thing, I'm glad you didn't go with that, because that would have been difficult. You'd have to read several things at once. But this makes reading really go very quickly. I kind of like watching a movie or listening to somebody read it to you. I know when I sat down with it, and I had a deadline to read it too, so that I knew I kept that in mind. I was saying, "Oh my, 1,400 pages! How am I going to do this?" But it was probably one of the most entertaining reading experiences that I've ever had. So the structure works amazingly well.
Oh well, that's nice of you to say, Ken. One of the things I did that I was of two minds of, and still really am, is that the first maybe 70, 80 pages is quite dense and kind of slow going and involves some characters who are quite peripheral to the book.
Rutherford B. Hayes and a guy who collects photographic plates. Is that Blurick?
Blurick was one of the settlers, and then he just kind of disappears. And Doc, who's this very, very mean scout, tries to bully Blurick and then gets very, very irritated, and he becomes sort of a a lifelong enemy of Blurick for no good reason. And I did that for two reasons. One was, you know, the war with the Nez Perce had no good, certainly no valid, no morally valid reason. And Doc, having picked on Blurick, then goes and picks on the Nez Perce for equally no good reason. And there were lots of men like that at that time who were just vicious and, as they put it, crazy for excitement. And the other thing is that I wanted the book, once the action began, to seem more dynamic and fluid and free, you know, as the chase actually started. So there had to be an origin of density, and then suddenly the book sort of springs into this stuff. So if readers pick up the book and, you know, find the first part unduly slow going, you know, forgive me and either persevere or skip the first 80 pages. I'll never know the difference. Yeah.
I would not suggest they skip it. I think it provides a lot of important context. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with William T. Volman, author of the new novel, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, which is book 5 in his Seven Dreams series of historical fiction. That part is called the inaugural address, and it's actually narrated by your fictional counterpart, William the Blind, who also appears in the other Seven Dreams as a narrator to help the reader out and provide this context. I thought you mentioned the density because it doesn't use the structure that you use in the rest of the book,
right?
With the stage analogy. But it's very Walt Whitman-esque. And you even repeat a line from his poem, War Dreams, Long Have They Passed, kind of over and over, like a refrain through that, that adds a lot. I was wondering, just for the, I had to look up the poem, but for the readers who don't know it, Bill, you know it well, I would imagine, but I have it here. Would you mind reading that? And
sure.
I just wanted to discuss something. And it's really just a few short lines. Do you think it's worthwhile to read all three stanzas there, or just the last one?
Why not?
Okay.
In midnight sleep, of many a face of anguish, of the look at first of the mortally wounded, of that indescribable look, of the dead on their backs with arms extended wide, I dream, I dream, I dream. Of scenes of nature, fields and mountains, of skies so beauteous after a storm, and at night the moon so unearthly bright, shining sweetly, shining down, where we dig the trenches and gather the heaps. I dream, I dream, I dream. Long have they passed, faces in trenches and fields, where through the carnage I moved with a callous composure, or away from the fallen. Onward I sped at the time, but now of their forms at night I dream, I dream, I dream.
Oh, that's a beautiful poem, of course,
Walt really
Whitman. The reason I asked you to read it, and thanks for doing that, I found what he's doing in that poem is something you do throughout the whole book, and that's contrasting the beauty of this continent, of this particular area here, the Pacific Northwest, in the book, in The Dying Grass, with the horrors of war, which is very clear from Whitman's poem.
I think so. And I also think that whenever a nation goes through a war or some other traumatic event, it resonates for a long time and it affects what happens in subsequent years. So, you know, in our post-September 11th America, you know, we're haunted, you know, by those attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and so forth. And we're haunted by our own reactions to them. So in a way, those attacks are still reverberating. And in the case of the Nez Perce War, many of the army participants had also been involved in the Civil War,
which you call the Secessionist War in the book?
That's right.
That's how they referred to it in the army?
Yeah, that was one of their terms.
Uh-huh.
It was also called, you know, the Outbreak or the War of the Rebellion. They had a number of names for it. But, you know, what those army officers and privates went through in the Civil War was so horrible and went on for such a long period that it must have made them more hardened, more used to violence, and also they didn't really want to think about it. General Howard said, you know, at one point that the chase of Joseph was really nothing, but, you know, occasionally he would feel, you know, a tiny little bit of the thrill of war as it went on and on. But it was an embarrassing campaign for the army. It was nothing for them compared to what they had suffered and what they had done. And that made them, I think, less able to appreciate the sufferings they were inflicting on the Nez Perce. And it made the whole country more determined to say, all right, let's get over this. Let's put it all behind us. And the way we're going to do that is we are going to conquer all the Indians and go all the way to the Pacific and have some bright and shining American dream.
The dying grass should be of particular interest to KABU listeners and all residents of Oregon and the whole Pacific Northwest. The book is set in what was used to be called the Department of the Columbia.
That's
territory
right.
There, which Idaho, Oregon, Washington State. From what you said, you did a lot of traveling in this area?
Yes. And the Army was constantly rejiggering its departments as various Indian troubles were settled, and they could phase out this or that department. General Howard took command of the Department of Columbia because his predecessor, General Canby, was the only general ever killed in an Indian war. He was killed under flag of truce by the Modocs. And the Modoc War was, in a way, sort of a rehearsal for the Nez Perce War, another needless war in which Indians were driven away from their homes for the benefit of stockmen. And then when you look at these areas a century later, you can't see why they had to drive the Indians out. The areas look much the same, almost empty.
And what would be an example of that, like Eastern Oregon?
You go to Joseph or Enterprise. There are some large farms, but it's also kind of a tourist place. You know, they call it the Switzerland of Oregon and so on and so forth.
You have an excerpt in the book from an actual travel guide that was written in 1992 or something.
That's right.
Yeah. Saying it used to be populated by the Nez Perce, and now it's for artists and tourists and hikers. And you after reading the book, you tend to read that paragraph with a little different perspective.
Right. You think, okay, so we had to do these horrible things so that this can happen.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So these artists could hang out in Joseph.
That's right. In the Modoc country, it seems like because of the water situation and maybe for other reasons, a lot of those settlements are just dead. There's some ghost towns there. The ranches seem to be shrinking a little bit. And if there were Modocs living traditionally in the lava beds now, it seems to me that they and the whites wouldn't be interfering with each other at all. So it just makes the whole thing, you know, more sickening when you think about it.
Right. In terms of your travels, too, you do have, again, for our KABU listening audience, most of you are in Portland or in Oregon. You have a passage in the book about our state. Quote, "A flattish deep blue disk all rich with white clouds, that's Oregon, the Garden of the West. Colorado may be the newest," and Colorado was just admitted to the Union, I think, a year before, 1877 or so. "But Oregon remains the most glamorous of our 38 states, farthest from hideous old war dreams."
That's right. Thank goodness, huh? Even if there were already a bunch of other Indian war dreams going on here.
So that leads me to ask the question, based on your travels that you did for the book, for research, did you have any favorite locations or locales, territories, areas?
Well, since I'm here in Portland, of course I should say Oregon.
Yes, especially tonight at Powell's.
So. That's right. But honestly, I mean, the country, without exception, is so beautiful. You know, from eastern Oregon through Washington and Idaho and Montana and Wyoming and across the Canadian border to Sitting Bull's former camp, it's all just stunning. It would be very hard to choose. It makes me very, very happy to be someone who was born on this continent. We have a beautiful continent, I would say.
We do.
Yeah.
And again, you do contrast throughout the book the beauty of the area with the horrors of the Nez Perce War and previous wars like the Civil War.
That's right.
I want to get to the characters in the book now. We talked a little bit about General Howard. basically, there's hundreds of characters in the book, and you inhabit them as the author and make them come alive on the page. Like Walt Whitman, you contain multitudes, Bill.
Oh, well, thank you.
But the main characters are General Oliver Otis Howard, and you call him actually this dream's hero in the book. And then Chief Joseph, who it turns out the actual Chief Joseph is a little different than the legend we have.
That's right.
The Red Napoleon. And there were other chiefs, too. Chief Joseph was just one of several. I was interested about General Howard in particular, because these are very, very complex characters, both of them. You have a quote in the glossary of Howard was considered incompetent by some, you say, but you say, as yourself, I think, and you probably, this is the way you believe, I myself find much to admire and compassionate in this man who paid a significant price for his kindness to oppressed people. And you also have another quote in the book. General Sherman said to General Howard in 1865, so right after the Civil War, God has limited the power of man, and though in the kindness of your heart you would alleviate the ills of humanity, it is not in your power. So we feel sympathetic to Howard, but you say when you started off, you thought he was kind of a bumbler, incompetent, but your view of him changed over your research and the writing of the book?
Well, I definitely started off thinking that he was a villain because, after all, he was the one who gave the Nez Perce their ultimatum, and then he was put in charge of chasing Joseph and forcing him to surrender. And really, you know, it was a shameful war. It never should have happened, in my opinion. And Howard, I think, half knew that, but didn't want to know it. So, you know, that never completely left my mind. But at the same time, I realized that Howard was indeed a very kind and very brave person. He took over the Freedmen's Bureau at the end of the Civil War, in hopes of rendering significant aid to the freed slaves.
And what I didn't know, but learned from your book, is Howard University is actually named for him.
That's right. And he was very, very generous with his own money in helping Howard University. He put up with untold insult and humiliation. His career was hampered. And in the end, he was accused of embezzlement and just dragged through the mud for years for basically trying to get African Americans some of the rights of citizens. So, you know, that makes me like the guy and respect him. But, you know, one of Howard's fatal faults, I'd say, is that, and maybe a good Christian should be this way, and in that case, maybe a good Christian should not be in charge of others. Because Howard believed people. He was very, very gullible. And when his subordinates said, yes, you know, we're going to really try to give the African Americans a fair deal and this and this and this, they'd be picking his pocket. They'd be spying on him to the president. And Howard repeatedly in his career was lied to. And General Sherman, who originally had a lot of fondness for Howard because of his bravery and effectiveness during the Civil War, ultimately, you know, came to disdain him and say that he, you know, was probably not a good businessman, you know, which was the ultimate insult, you know, from Sherman. And Howard wasn't. He took everything very personally. He ended up believing that Joseph had lied to him and betrayed him the way other people had. It wasn't Joseph's fault that these young men rose up against the settlers and started killing and raping and so forth. Howard might have never understood that an Indian chief was not like a general, that he couldn't say, do this, and all the men would do that. Howard also, being, you know, such a strong Christian, was very much offended by the non-Christian beliefs of the non-treaty Nez Perce. So they would say, you know, the earth is our mother, we must not sell our mother. And he didn't want to hear it. It just made him infuriated. He had a very short fuse, and he does deserve some of the blame for the start of the Nez Perce War, unfortunately.
It just seems a person of that empathy and his compassion kind of worked against him as a general in the cavalry at the time.
That's right. If you know, if Joseph had had taken Jesus to be his personal savior and become a monogamous husband and agreed to be a farmer, Howard would have done anything for him. But Joseph didn't want to. And what's all the sadder is that Joseph's great success was with the Apache chief, Cochise. He persuaded Cochise to surrender and come onto a reservation of his choosing. And then a few years later, the government decided, well, we're just going to concentrate the Apaches and put Cochise on a reservation that he doesn't like. And then the Apache War started again, and Howard had to say in private, well, the government, you know, has broken all my promises. So, in fact, he wasn't capable of doing very much good for the Indians. Nobody was, which makes the story even worse. Howard was such a well-meaning person. He wanted to do what he could. The outcome would have been the same, I think, no matter what Howard did.
And there's some beautiful passages in there when he's thinking of his family, his wife and his children back on 10th and Morrison in Portland. That gives you an idea what a loving person he was. And yet there was a certain rage or blindness to the other, which I guess is your major theme in the Seven Dreams anyway. These others do not get along with each other. They can't understand each other.
I think I would have really liked General Howard if he were one of my neighbors. I would have enjoyed talking to him.
Morning, Bill. How are you doing this morning?
Yeah.
Yeah. He seems that way.
Yeah, I think so.
As long as he didn't think you were a Jesus-hating bigamist or something like that.
That's right. But even then, I mean, if we were neighbors, mm-hmm. I bet he would have been perfectly nice to me. So, you know, he had an extra soft spot for the freed slaves because so many of them had been Christianized. When I was at Bowdoin College, you know, where Howard went to school, they have his archives. There was something very touching, you know, that I got to handle. There was a letter to him from Sojourner Truth when he was being pilloried, you know, in the Senate about the Freedmen's Bureau, and they were calling him a crook and so on and so forth. And she wrote him a letter of consolation, you know, and it's very, very sweet to see this, you know, in her own handwriting.
Getting away from the characters now towards the events in the book, we had mentioned before you wrote this multi-volume treatise or essay, though essay doesn't seem to encompass the scope and the depth of the work, called Rising Up and Rising Down. And there you attempted to create what you called a moral calculus for determining whether or not violence is a legitimate response to any given situation. Did you apply that moral calculus in writing The Dying Grass? Was that in the back of your mind?
I guess I have a little bit, you know, in all my books, ever since I finished Rising Up and Rising Down. It helped me to write my novel Europe Central, which is about the struggle between Hitler and Stalin and the people under them.
And Shostakovich plays a big part in that book.
Yeah, he does. It made me realize that two people fighting on opposing sides for evil regimes can still make good and evil choices, even if the practical outcomes might be quite insignificant. So I kept thinking about that kind of thing. Well, like, what should General Howard have done? What could he have done? You know, what could Looking Glass have done? And to me, it makes the story more haunting, really, to think about that stuff. Tolstoy probably would have told General Howard, what you should do is resign from the army, you know, and apologize to the Indians and say, you know, I've hurt you rather than helped you, and I'm really, really sorry. And that wouldn't have accomplished anything either. You know, so what should he have done? I don't know.
Maybe given him a little bit more peace of mind. But
yeah, maybe. Yeah.
But you also quote in the book, apparently came out with a 2-volume autobiography around 1909, something like that. 1907.
It was published, just before he died.
And it seems like there are passages that you quote in there that make him seem much more open-minded looking back on his career than you'd think he was in 1877 during the course of events in the book.
That's right. Well, really, he was all over the map. You know, and there's one point near the end of the book where I collect some of his comments about Indians on the reservation. And, you know, he'd say, well, I think that the reservation is just a system to impoverish the Indians. And, you know, if we put whites on a reservation and under threat of starvation, force them to be something they weren't, it would be so horrible. And a lot of them would probably starve. They could do it, but it would be very cruel.
Which is amazing coming from a cavalry general, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
That thought.
And then, you know, a little bit later he was saying, you know, I used to have nightmares about Indians. And then finally he was saying, you know, when you deal with Indians, you just have to give them orders and understand that they have to be executed without delay. And that's all there is to it.
Okay, there's the other extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you said, he was a very, very complicated man. And maybe all men and all women are very, very complicated, and you just get to see it with General Howard.
The Dying Grass is the fifth book in the Seven Dreams series. What's the status of the remaining two books, which are actually book four and book seven, because you published The Rifles, which is book six.
That's right.
In this.
Well, book seven is about Hopi and Navajo in the 1980s. And I completed a substantial amount of that book in 1986. When the Navajo were about to be expelled from the joint use area, at least in part, so that Peabody Coal could do a bunch of strip mining there. And the other dream, I had originally wanted to be about King Philip's War in Rhode Island and the Great Swamp and all that kind of stuff.
What year was that, or that time period?
That was in the 1600s.
Okay.
But I'm worried that it might be too close to Argall, you know, which is set in the same period.
17th century. Yeah.
Yeah. So I might possibly make the dream about the annexation of Hawaii. You know, anyway, I have, you know, a few years to figure that out. I don't want to start any more work on the Seven Dreams for a while because I want them all to be different.
What's the writing project you're working on now? Before the interview, you talked about energy and fracking and Fukushima.
That's right. I'm writing a book called Carbon Ideologies, and it's written for people of, you know, maybe 100 years from now, if there are still people then. You know, when I was researching Dying Grass, that's when I really got to learn about the extermination of the buffalo. And I had always thought that the buffalo were wiped out simply out of greed and carelessness, and that played a large part in it. But then I found that it was also deliberate policy, you know.
To starve the Indians.
Oh. Yeah. Once the buffalo were gone, the Indians were gone, and General Sherman actually said as much. But, you know, it's when you look back on what happened to the buffalo, you know, it's too late to really do much about it now.
Yeah, there's just a few.
Right.
Mainly in Yellowstone, I guess.
That's right. And, yeah, you know, there are some commercially raised buffalo for meat and so forth. But who knows if they'll even last. I don't know if the genetic diversity suffices. But, you know, there's no real urgency when we think about it. We feel sad. It's like thinking about the passenger pigeons and other things.
The dodo bird.
Yeah, yeah. It's something irrevocable. And so I'm trying to think about the bad choices that we humans are making regarding climate change in that way. So if there are people 100 years from now, I'm guessing that they will live in a greatly impoverished, hot, dark, and probably somewhat radioactive world. And they will be wondering why we did what we did. So I'm going to Japan and West Virginia and Bangladesh and Colorado and asking people that so that the future will know. So that's my current book.
We've been talking with William T. Volman, author of the new novel, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, which is book five in a Seven Dreams series of historical fiction. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Bill for visiting us at KABU, and for all of you for listening.
Thanks again for having me, Ken.
So like the eagle, I like the hawk. Hear the drums of the Nez Perce people, listen to the mountains talk. Hey, yeah, oh, hey, oh, hey. Oh, Hey, 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 hey,